Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
Welcome back, listeners.
Yes, welcome back.
This was a much shorter wait.
Yes, and we thank you for hanging out and now getting two in 1 month. Hey, now.
Yeah, and maybe three if I can convince you to cover Santa Claus versus the Martians. We'll talk about it.
Oh, I do like the sound of that.
But yeah, we're jumping right back into The Haunting of Hill House, the miniseries on Netflix. In our first episode on this subject, we covered the original 1963, The Haunting, and not so wild about that one.
Nope.
But we did also cover the differences in the adaptation of the miniseries that Mike Flanagan has taken on, and the sort of spectacle, because it really is a feat unto itself that that he's gotten so much work done in so little time, and it's as good as it is.
He's like good, and it makes me irritated in a way.
Like,
because I was going through his good. Yeah, he's exactly. Because I was going through stuff. I mean, I didn't love Oculus. I know you did. You liked it a great deal.
I liked it a great deal.
But I loved Hush. I loved Absentia. That's one of those first kind of hipster horror things that I think I remember seeing from that particular era of film.
Yeah, low budget, conceptually great.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about Hush, Gerald's Game.
Yeah.
Just, you know, a kind of perfect little gem of a movie that I feel bad. Some of these Netflix movies, I mean, because they don't really have a life outside of Netflix, you kind of feel that like they might not get as much traction as they deserve. But he's done some amazing work.
Yeah.
And like, he really deserves all the accolades. I think as far as like studio stuff, the Ouija Origins of Evil,
the one he did?
I believe so. It's the throwback to the 70s story that actually the actress who plays young Shirley is also in.
And she was Annabelle.
Older Shirley.
Oh, yeah.
Annabelle, that same
the
actress?
Creation or Annabelle the Origin or whatever, that one, that's the same actress as young Shirley.
Ah.
Yeah, because Jackson and I were watching that being like, what? We know this girl from somewhere. Where do I know this girl from?
Yeah, the kids are familiar looking. At least, yeah, those two. I think the actress who plays Theo and the little actress who plays Shirley as well.
I think the only thing I didn't love was that Before I Wake, and we talked about that on the show before.
We actually haven't released that.
Never mind. Never talked about it ever.
So we're jumping back in now, episode 4, The Twin Thing, written by Scott Kosar.
Right, who we know from The Machinist, which we've been talking about
right? It's come up a lot.
It seems strange because it's not a film I ever think of.
I think about it a lot, you know, and I think the meme comes up from time to time. The Christian Bale in just gaunt horror, empty. Yeah, that image comes up a lot.
Also,
but he wrote that one, didn't direct it.
Right. Writer of that. He also wrote the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
The 2003, which was one of the first films that actually ever turned my stomach.
The hook scene?
Yeah. And, you know, like, we watch this gross shit all the time, and I'm like, no problems. And that one really gets me going. But something that you were reminded of vaguely and he was involved in is the remake of Amityville Horror. And you were talking about the real family, the Lutzes, from Amityville Horror.
Yeah. So in theme of haunted houses, especially the kinds of situations that people carry with them. So the original story of the Amityville haunting, while the likelihood is that was mostly invented for publicity and not really the case, I mean, it was the scene of a brutal family murder.
Mm-hmm.
The haunting, not so much.
Right.
Mostly manufactured. One of the first widely covered stories where Ed and Lorraine Warren become involved. scientifically, none of that stuff holds up in terms of it's horror. However, the fallout on the family, like, that's tangible. And there's the entire documentary, My Amityville Haunting, that you brought to my attention. I don't think I've seen more than a couple clips.
I went through this whole, like, Amityville thing for a while. And that film was particularly sad.
Yeah.
Particularly very sad. And it kind of ties in with, we're going to start talking about episode 4, and it talks about the twins, and it talks especially about Luke and his relationship to the horror and the haunting and the home family life that led to addiction, that led to certain things. And that's very similar to Daniel Lutz and his experience living with an abusive father such as George Lutz and kind of being exploited by the Warrens, which really is what happened. I wish there was a way that everyone could see, like, the eye rolling that I was doing when you were explaining, like, the Warrens. Like, there's something that really bothers me about them.
Yeah.
And it's exploitative.
It would be interesting to do an episode. Especially now with the Conjuring series and the Nun, there's plenty of subject matter to be mined in terms of, like, the adaptations of the Warren stories. And also, like, there's been tons written on just the chicanery and the nonsense and the bullshit that they've put people through in these, you know, spectacles of exorcisms and investigations. And
it's
all
shenanigans.
That stuff. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like, I would love to believe these things are true. I no one wants that more than me. I think that'd be great, but these two were charlatans.
Yeah. So that the Amityville Haunting, I think there's got to be an influence there in terms of the Luke character.
And Scott Kosar's involvement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the earlier episode, we talked about how Luke convinces Theo to, you know, put him in the dumbwaiter, and you know, he just wants a ride. That's the whole point. It's a kid size ride.
Yeah, perfect.
And then he has a fucking nightmare experience in the basement of the house. I guess we get a little bit more in terms of his terror in the house. Mm. But frankly, the basement scene's all I would have needed to be a junkie later in life.
It's like, true.
It wouldn't take much to unravel me, especially if you're starting. He's, you know what, like 6 years old.
He's because they're the littlest kids there.
Yeah, the twins.
Listen, I think, though, the thing that's haunting him beyond the addiction is pretty fucking terrifying, too. That's a great image. It's a great thing that reminds me very much of The Gentleman in Buffy.
Oh, yeah.
It's very much the same way of moving, very much reminiscent of that. And not only does this follow Luke in his childhood, but it follows him through his addiction in his adulthood as well.
I guess he kind of touches on the idea in terms of, like, what might drive someone into debilitating heroin addiction. And it really, I mean, the tragedy is compounded because the family, when we first meet them as adults, he's crossed the line so many times and he's burned every conceivable bridge that, like, it's kind of heartbreaking that Shirley kind of like holds a grudge. And I get it. Like, he's burned her a number of times. And at this point, like, you know, it turns out he was the first tenant of her, you know, or her, like, whatever, the guest house.
Yeah.
And she's got a lot to lose, and I get that you kind of want to limit exposure, especially when you've got kids. But the way she just kind of, like, tosses off these lines about Luke, like,
what's the cap? 20? 30? Here's 100. You can shoot up the rest. I don't care. This is the last I ever give you. No more loans, no more treatment centers, nothing. The store's closed. I'm done.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking. And he is kind of the stranded family member. It's funny that the father is, like, their resentment has pushed the father away. And then Luke, the youngest of the family, like through his addiction has kind of pushed himself away from the mm-hmm. rest of the family. And so we've got them at the far ends and the rest of the siblings kind of like dealing with these family issues through and through.
Can I have the hat?
I think it's too big for you, honey.
I don't know. You'll grow into it. That is a big boy hat, all right. You want this? Well, you are a big boy now. But you know, big boys, they know the difference between what's real and what's imaginary. So what do you say, champ? You like it?
He loves it.
Well, how do you know that?
It's a twin thing.
So I don't know this. I only ever knew one set of twins growing up. I don't know. I don't know very many of them, but in this story, Luke and Nell are twins and they share this kind of connection.
As twins supposedly do.
Apparently that's the thing to do, right? Well, now we know that Nell, that she has died, and Luke suddenly gets this very cold, cold feeling.
Yeah.
And they're not in the same area. They're not even in the same state. They're across the country from one another. And this is happening. And so they have this connection.
Yeah. I think it wasn't until maybe the episode after where it clicked, because he's been a junkie. But at this point in the story, he's 90 days clean. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge accomplishment. But when he does kind of freeze up, it just kind of seems like he's in withdrawal again.
Right, so no one believes that he's sober.
Yeah.
And even as the viewer, you're like, what, this guy, there's something really junky. And because the first time we ever really meet him as an adult, he's stealing from his older brother, which is another so sad scene, because his brother just lets him.
Yeah, he's resigned to this idea that like he can't be helped.
And just gives him some money and wants him to fuck off, essentially.
Yeah. And the way Luke talks about his arms and legs being cold and stiff.
Yeah.
It didn't hit me until much later that he was feeling his sister's loss. He was feeling his sister being disconnected from this mortal coil.
So beyond just being a junkie, stealing things from his older brother, his sister has died, so now he's very cold, and he doesn't understand that at this particular point in time. He doesn't know that it has actually to relate with her exactly. When his addiction is really clawing at his back, he starts to see something that followed him as a child.
Yeah.
And there is a lovely scene where it really kind of listen, if you find a hat in an old house, don't take it. It's fucking someone else's, and they're going to want to come take it back from you. So don't you take it. Don't touch it. Leave it alone. They're going to take that hat from you.
That's funny to think that they were, I mean, regularly as children, they're encountering everything from like tea sets.
Yeah.
To like old, like vanity mirrors and tables, and in his case, little Luke finds a bowler hat that is two sizes too big, so it fits over his ears, but he loves it. And yeah, for the parents not to have a moment where like, oh yeah, it's but yeah, dusty old hat. No, that's
no. Don't put that on your head.
No, that's a terrible sign.
Don't you dare. Don't you dare.
But he's a little kid, and everybody looks at him wearing an oversized hat, well, and they're like, oh, isn't that adorable?
Look what ended up happening.
And haunted. Episode 5 is called The Bent Neck Lady, and that is the name that Nell has given kind of her character. All the kids see different things in the house.
Yeah.
And Nell
sees the bent neck lady.
Sees the bent neck lady. And this is the closest we get to, I've seen in reviews kind of written up as like a J-horror inspired character.
Absolutely.
But I see that. I mean, she's not wet. I guess that's the only thing.
But it's like the stringy hair.
Yeah, not a clear image of the face. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, a bent neck lady who, you know, depending on where she's spotted, she's either like standing in background or hovering above a sleeping Nell.
Yeah, she'll do all sorts of crazy shit.
And so they've introduced this idea that Nell suffers from sleep paralysis mm-hmm. from time to time. We've talked about sleep paralysis from time to time on this show.
Yeah.
We talked about The Nightmare, the documentary.
Right,
in
right.
quotes documentary.
Which was really one of the first times where I saw other people who just, like, see the same things that I do. And I was like, what? I am not the only person.
Yeah, wow.
You know?
I would imagine that's weird to think that, like, thousands of people probably had that same experience.
And that I was, like, in my 30s before.
Yeah.
That I knew that other people had this. It's crazy. So that's actually how Nell meets her husband, because he is a sleep, like, doctor man.
And you said the first occurrence happened...
when I was 6.
Do you ever see anything during these episodes?
Like what?
People sometimes say they see things.
I know this all must sound really weird.
Not at all. Sleep paralysis is actually more common than you think, but it's completely harmless. Which is easy for the sleep tech to say, right? And so you've never sought treatment or done any other sleep studies?
No. I Googled it. I was surprised to find that there was something to be done.
Okay. So, during the night, you cycle through different stages of sleep. Mm-hmm. In the deepest stage, your brain basically switches off the muscles to stop you from acting out your dreams. Some people just come out of that stage quicker than others. Your brain wakes up before it starts the engines again. It takes a minute for your muscles to catch up.
About the things I sometimes see?
It's funny, the things people sometimes report. Shadow people, animals, dead loved ones. Hallucinations are actually fairly common because of the disrupted boundary between your dream state and your wakefulness. So your dreams may carry over.
A little spill.
Listen, it's bad enough to have like sleep paralysis or where you wake up and you're still kind of in the dream. But then to have that in a haunted house where you have a bent neck lady that's always kind of staring at you. Can you imagine?
So I guess a throwback to the first episode, there is a really sweet moment. Well, I mean, it follows her terror. But when her screams wake up the family and her older brother's the first one to come in, but the dad kind of, you know, it's his like hero moment where mm-hmm. he comforts her. And there's a really nice conversation about dreams spilling over into mm-hmm. waking life. And I thought that was a really sweet way to put it, if that was what was happening.
Yeah, except for he was gaslighting her. You son of a bitch.
But yeah, this episode being Nell-centered, especially after we've already watched, well, we haven't watched her die, but we know that Nell is dead. She's kind of the, you know, she's the magnet drawing the family back together. Mm-hmm. But that this whole episode is mostly in flashback, and we get her full story. We get this kind of haunted by sleep paralysis, but it also brought her husband into the picture, and they are mm-hmm. such a sweet couple.
Yeah.
And we get like the scenes at her wedding, and it's really nice. Intercut with her like her lifelong struggle with this situation, and you really like she sells the terror of those moments.
Oh yeah.
And I can only imagine, like I've been reading about sleep paralysis for years, but it totally makes sense that before any modern science, people would absolutely assume that like something spiritual and terrifying is happening to me. I would totally think it was a incubus or some, you know, demonic
holding
presence.
Holding you down.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
And I guess even I would wager that like the overlap between cats and the way people talk about like cats stealing babies' breath or like cats like sitting on people's chest and doing that, that like if you had a combination of sleep paralysis and a cat, like yeah, you might think like there is some terrible otherworldliness happening to you right in that moment. And so Nell sells it, and you kind of sometimes we get the overlap of the bent neck lady, but sometimes no. Sometimes
it's just terrifying enough on its own.
Yeah. So without giving spoilers, Nell's life doesn't... Well, we already know that it doesn't end well, but that things begin to unravel and that her narrative starts to take on a similar one to her mother's. That's kind of where the tragedy starts seeping in. It's funny that her psychologist is played by Russ Tamblyn from the original cast of The Haunting, and he seems... Well, he's not a great therapist. I think all too often takes her word for whether she's taking her medications and whether she's actually dealing with the issues.
Yeah. He's not a good one. But it's not, though, that Theo doesn't know this. And it's not, though, that even Shirley doesn't know that this therapist is not good. Like, everyone knows this. But for some reason, this is allowed to continue. Because similarly to Luke, in some of the depression or the mental illness that is kind of starting to surround Nell late in her life, the family kind of just writes her off.
Yeah, well, I think she also, like,
secludes herself.
She's physically remote. She's in a different state than a couple of them. But, yeah, that she is kind of isolating herself at this point.
I mean, in the very first episode, she is calling around.
Yeah.
And the siblings are all too busy, essentially, or just don't want to deal with it to answer the phone. And the only person who actually answers her phone call is her father.
Yeah, Timothy Hutton is...
He's good in this.
Yeah, I was so sympathetic to his character, especially, like, you know, the full arc. Did the blue contacts bother you at all? Did you pick up on that? No, they didn't?
No, it didn't bother me. I thought he was so good.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think to sort of make sure everybody gets that they're the same person in terms of Timothy Hutton playing the same Hugh Crane character as Henry Thomas, as the younger Hugh Crane, they're paired with... I think it was more conspicuous when it's Henry Thomas for some reason, but I felt like the blue contacts with like a darker outer rim, I don't know, it distracted me a little bit.
I didn't think anything of it.
I might have been overthinking it.
I didn't think any... Well, so many people in my family are like that with the black hair and blue eyes. So I guess maybe to me I was like, that's normal.
But yeah, so that the dad is the only one to pick up the phone and... He's certainly, I mean, whatever, the parental instincts kick in, but he also recognizes that, like, something is really wrong.
Right.
Beyond what she's telling him, something is off.
Nell?
Daddy.
Honey, are you okay? What time is it?
Do you remember the bent-neck lady?
Which is something that parents, I think, have. I remember when I got into a really terrible car wreck as a kid when I was 16. I had totaled my car very bad. And I called my dad. And I meant to talk to my mom. So I called the house phone. My dad answers the phone. And I say to him, I need to talk to mom. And I was very clear. And I was very whatever. And my dad says he remembers me calling and sounding... Even though I was making complete sense, when he handed the phone to my mom, he goes, I think something's wrong with her.
Oh.
And then when I talked to my mom, I broke down and was like hysterical, but I kept my shit together when I needed to talk to my dad. Aww. And so that's actually, I think, you know, parents, and to some extent, maybe it's a father-daughter kind of thing, knows that something isn't right, even though she's... You know, she says she's fine.
Right, yeah.
And he knows that that's just not true.
Yeah. Later on, we find out it's not the first type of call that he's had in that scenario. At least this time around, he's wise to it.
Mm-hmm. The next episode, episode 6, is called Two Storms, directed and written by Mike Flanagan, but also written by Jeff Howard. It juxtaposes the two storms. Wow, it's very, you know, telling.
Literal.
There and there. There is a storm in 1992 that only happens at Hill House.
As centralized as storms get.
Yeah. It's one of those micro wind things. Breaks all the windows in the house.
Yeah, it's a hailstorm to boot.
And then there's a storm in current days.
Yeah, during...
Which is a shit storm.
Yeah.
That's what that is.
Night before Nell's proper funeral.
So the entire family's at the house, at the funeral home.
Yeah.
And lots of bad shit goes on.
Took notice that Mike Flanagan co-wrote this one as well. And I'm sure he, you know, had a script polish on a number of these episodes. But the directing in this episode, high bar and high marks, because there are a number of long, uninterrupted takes in this episode. And it's not like a, you know, dining room table kind of setting. It is taking place in the funeral home section of Shirley's, you know, well, funeral home and home. But there are special effects involved. There are people in the background. There are transitions to Hill House. And they all happen flawlessly.
The set of Hill House was the most extraordinary set I have ever been on. They built an actual two-story house in which we could walk everywhere in the house. And in fact, we did it all in one take in episode 6, which you should see.
Now that the whole family is together, we've got the adults dealing with their father, Timothy Hutton, in this case. And so everybody is kind of, it's one part like reminiscing about Nell. It's a throwback to the terrifying night of the storm when they're all kids kind of trapped in the house and Nell goes missing.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of good drama, like really fluidly put together in this episode.
There's also, for the adults, a little bit of drinking, which is leading to not clear thinking.
Yeah.
And some emotions that are now kind of heightened because of this. And, you know, I really feel bad for Timothy Hutton. Once you see the whole picture for really what it is. And that's kind of one of the first times you discover Timothy Hutton is talking to somebody.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, no, we haven't gotten a lot of time with them. So at this point, like,
at first it seems like, okay, he's kind of talking to himself. And then later then we're privy to seeing kind of what he's seeing.
Yeah. And so that everybody has kind of left this house haunted in their own way. He's no different. He just kind of carries the burden differently.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've really liked his kind of downtrodden character.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, all the good intent. When he's a young dad, he's kind of the perfect dad. It's a seemingly impossible task to have 5 children.
Yeah.
And they're all, I mean, at the time, well adjusted, and they're a tight unit, and there's a lot of love in that family, and they're all like impossibly smart and well educated.
It's true.
And here, you know, here's Hugh Crane as perfect dad, who, you know, later in life is persona non grata.
Yeah.
And like loves his kids still. Like that part never goes away, but they just don't fucking want him around.
And he knows it, and it's very sad. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of some of the articles after old George Bush.
Yeah, George H.W.
Yeah, passing away. And in the eulogy for George W., the eulogy that George W. Bush gives, he talks so much about not exactly how old George Bush loved the kids, but how much he loved his wife. Mm. And there was a lot of different articles being written about it because it says a different kind of thing about a person when the father and the mother love each other so much. Like, it's such a, I think, a unique kind of relationship. And that's Timothy Hutton's relationship with Carla Gugino.
Yeah.
Really, really loved each other. And yeah, then this family was kind of, you know, based off of that for then to not really know at this point what happened to Carla Gugino.
Yeah, but know that for the rest of his life, he's walking around having had a leg taken out from under him.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's really, really touching. I think that's one of the sweetest parts of the film, of the show.
And I guess the storm brings into focus the kind of routine where they are meant to be fixing up this house, and now the, you know, these, all these windows that need to be replaced, but now there's also a mold problem that's presented itself.
What's that smell?
That is a smell of ruin.
Mold.
Same thing. I can't. Storm was just last night. It can't be all the way down here. It can't be down here. Please don't be down here.
What does that mean?
It means we got water pooling all the way down here, three floors down.
That's really bad.
Father Mucker.
Really, Dad?
This kind of rot in Hill House, it kind of becomes like his white whale.
Because at the same time, what's happening, he has this perfect relationship with Carla Gugino, and it's starting to unravel. In that, as the mold grows, she's starting to get wacky, and she's starting to become very untethered to what's happening.
Yeah, and I guess it's a slow build so that you can't really get angry at him for being, you know, imperceptive. Like, they've all got a full plate.
Right.
And that her unraveling does kind of take its time. At the same time, like, he's more and more involved with the house itself, and so he's not involved with the kids, and it is kind of, you know, everybody's going these different directions.
I can fix it.
Episode 7, Eulogy. We are still now dealing with the aftermath of the storm.
Yeah.
It is time to have this funeral. All sorts of shit is happening. Written by Charisse Castro-Smith, directed obviously again by Mike Flanagan, we learn more about the Dudley's story. Mr. and Mrs. Dudley, the caretaker, which is just like in the book, the caretakers.
Yeah.
These caretakers live off the grounds because they have learned now to not stay in the house after dark.
Yeah, they serve dinner and they're out.
Yeah, they peace right out.
Yeah, no, the recurring theme of these long takes, and you mentioned it before, the idea that it's pretty frequent that outside characters have long monologues that
in
kind
every
of
episode.
Inform.
Yeah.
And in this case, we get a long conversation with Mr. Dudley talking. Well, he recognizes that Mrs. Crane is not doing so well. And he picks up on it and kind of mentions, like, maybe she should take some time off away out of the house. And he shares a story about why him and his wife don't hang around after dark. And it's a great character piece. Like, just as far as, like, I'm imagining, like, people auditioning with this kind of scene. Like, that's
what I felt like. Every episode had a scene where I was like, that's a great monologue. If someone took that into an audition, that would knock it out of the park. And this is definitely one of those. The Dudleys, for all their self-righteousness, especially Mrs. Dudley, you feel this incredible affection for, I think. And sympathy for, once you hear kind of their stories, why they don't stay in the house anymore.
Yeah.
Their relationship with the house and kind of like this circumstance that has put them there.
Yeah. Yeah. To talk about it would be to spoil elements, but yeah, it's also called Eulogy because this is the episode where Nell is eulogized,
right.
And there is the cemetery scene. This is a really sad Luke, eulogy that he gives, and kind of talks about them being twins, and it's been a twin thing from the beginning, but that she's always kind of been his tether to this world. And the way that I really like the description, it's kind of a throwback to the Cranes talking about how Mrs. Crane was the kite and Mr. Crane was the cord.
Your mom and I were married 15 years together, 5 before that. She used to say she was the kite and I was the line. Like, she was a creature of the clouds and I was a creature of the earth. And she'd say that without me, she'd become untethered and she would float away up into the... And then without her, I would just, you know, crash, just drop right down to the ground and, you know. But together, we...
Okay, so jumping from episode 7, Eulogy, into episode 8, Witness Marks. So Witness Marks are a deep cut. Just in terms of terminology, I'd forgotten I had listened to this whole series, but a branch off of the This American Life podcast was called Shit Town.
Okay.
From Serial and This American Life, I'm Brian Reed. This is Shit Town.
So it's involved, but it follows one particular guy who is a fascinating human being who is no longer with us. But in his eccentricities, he took up horology, specifically the fixing of antique clocks.
Do you know what witness marks are? They're scars. Little marks inside the clock. Scrapes, lines, divots from tools, gears, pieces removed from the clock. They're basically evidence of repairs that have been done to the clock and what the clock was. And with antique clocks, you almost never have a repair record. So you have to learn how to read the witness marks so you can understand what was done to the machine and how it was meant to function. Witness marks tell the story of the piece if you know how to read them.
And, you know, extrapolate from that in terms of, like, the house and this family.
Right.
And the idea of if something even can be fixed. It is funny that after that whole intro to the episode, like, we can't actually talk about what it is without spoiling it.
We can't mention that.
Okay. Well, in the episode prior, in Eulogy, we do get the first moment where Hugh had to address the night of with the authorities because something terrible has happened. There is a dead body. And when the cop talks about, what about the other body?
Yeah.
And at this point, as the audience, we're just like, what other body?
Yeah.
Who's this other body? And when he talks about it as already being been resolved, he's alluding to having discovered the body behind a wall in the basement with
which
the mold.
Which is very like Cask of Amontillado sort of.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking Stir of Echoes.
Okay,
a bit,
fair enough.
But same.
The kids being pulled out of their bed in the middle of the night, and we're talking to them, of course. You know it's a mess, right? And we haven't even talked about the other body.
That didn't have anything to do with us.
Of course not, but you can fix it right here. You like to fix things. You're good at fixing things. I keep hearing this about you, is that right?
I'm not so sure anymore.
You leave a lawyer up, suddenly we can't fix this. This mess begins to spread until it becomes bigger than both of us.
This episode is kind of these little reveals of these moments in Hill House. We've got the old chest of drawers that the oldest son finds and he wants to fix up for his mom.
Yeah.
And in it is a photograph of Poppy Hill, the original bride of the house. And at the time, she's kind of outfitted like a flapper girl.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Because
like
she's
the,
like sassy. And
yeah, of the roaring 20s variety. And so we've kind of, you know, that's one seed that's planted. Meanwhile, you know, Mother Crane is steadily falling apart. You know,
right.
The son thinks like, oh, this will cheer up mom. It's like, oh, kids in the presence of mental illness thinking like, oh, like what can we do to fix her?
Yeah. Which is very, very sad.
When we were recording our Patreon episode, we were talking about our first reactions to it, and I think I probably focused on crying.
Yeah. Because I said this is a show where you're going to laugh and cry and get scared shitless as well.
And I was
it's
like,
all the things.
I got two of the three so far. I think at the time I'd only watched the first, like, five episodes. I said, I've been scared. I've cried more than my share.
Right.
When's the laughter kick
yeah,
in?
Yeah, you thought I was like a psychopath. But because there are such, like, I don't know who wrote this scene, the scene that we're going to talk about, but it's like someone who, and I never had a sister, but I had girlfriends, and it is such a freaking like real thing.
Yeah, it's really natural. It almost feels like an ad lib at just how it's got the humanity of the Fight Club punch in the ear.
Yes.
Okay, so Shirley is, it's Halloween, I guess the night after they bury Nell is Halloween proper. Right. So like the family is out trick-or-treating. Shirley is not up to it, so she stays home. Weird shit starts happening. When Theo comes to visit, they've been fighting about something we won't spoil. But when it does for a moment become physical and Theo punches Shirley in the tit.
Yes.
I laughed out loud. Like, I probably shouldn't, but I did. And I was like, that was the moment. That was, all right. That,
yeah,
that made me laugh.
It's so
really
funny
hard.
Because it's so real. It's such a sister thing to do.
And she reacts with that same disbelief that, like, did you just
punch me in the boob?
And she owns it. A bit like, Theo comes around. She's like,
did you just punch me in the boob?
Yeah. Yeah. You that's what you get. You get punched in the fucking boob. And you get evicted from my fucking house.
While those two are fighting, the rest of the family, they're looking for Luke because he has disappeared. He's disappeared with Shirley's credit card. They think the worst because they think he is a junkie that's going on now, a junkie bender.
Yeah, he's got her car, too.
Exactly.
He's off to the races.
Timothy Hutton, however, thinks like, hey, guys, we should probably be concerned because he kind of knows where Luke's going.
Yeah, you get the sense that, like, between Nell winding up at Hill House that, yeah, Luke can't be too far behind.
Right.
Now you're going to listen to me. There's a lot you don't know. Thought I could keep you kids safe if you didn't know, but for 20 years I've been holding the door closed because I knew there were monsters on the other side. Do you understand me?
Not even a little.
Our family is like an unfinished meal to that house, and your brother is walking right back into... That house is the most dangerous place in the world for all of us.
So Timothy Hutton is in the car with Stephen. It's funny, I call Hugh Crane Timothy Hutton, but the son, he's always Steve.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to have to pronounce that dude's name.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
But so they are together for the first time, probably in 20 years, it seems.
Stephen does not want the dad in the car.
No. It's funny that they even flew in on the same plane, but one was in first class and the right. Dad was in coach. But yeah, so that they're having this sit down moment, it starts to come out. Like they are talking about this, the shit that the dad claimed he was protecting the kids from all along. And it's good. It's getting good. Like we're starting to get some details out of Hugh Crane and really, you know, they're hashing it out, and some of the descriptions like go back to like the kind of poetry that that Shirley Jackson puts in her writing. Mm-hmm. It's really, really great.
So the last couple episodes, I think we'll just put together. What you need to know is everyone now is being drawn back into the house.
Yeah.
And different kind of things bring them there. And what they discover is, okay, Luke is clearly going to the house. Timothy Hutton knew that all along.
Yeah, Shirley gets the call that her credit card's been used at a gas station in the area.
Yeah. So everyone now on their way to the house.
The photo of Poppy Hill that comes up in episode 8, where Ms. Dudley recognizes who it is and she gives the backstory, Poppy Hill kind of manifests in mm-hmm. these Carlo Gugino scenes. And I like this approach way more than the inner monologue in the original film and the sort of unraveling. You know, there's a lot that could be said in terms of like the family's reaction to mom's hysteria.
Right.
As far as like the age-old tradition of ignoring women's problems as hysteria is ever present here as well. But, you know, it's Hill House. There's a lot more to it.
Right. Poppy Hill is that voice that kind of is whispering in Carlo Gugino's ear. And Carlo Gugino is already starting to come kind of untethered, unhinged. Now she's hearing certain things that are not too pleasant to hear.
Yeah.
And we find out Poppy Hill's a real bitch. Like, you don't, she doesn't really have any other purpose or goal other than to cause confusion or irritation to everyone in the house.
Yeah.
Like, she's just a bad person.
On its face, it doesn't seem like misery-loving company. You kind of have to sort of, like, pull the camera back and think of her in the context of the home. And, like, she is menace.
Yeah.
She is not going to give anyone good advice.
No. She is stirring shit up because she likes the drama of the whole thing.
Yeah. I did like that they made use of the, like, rock storm story in Carlo Gugino's past. I think it's one of the reasons that the original Nell is brought to the house is that she's understood to be a center part of this story.
But I've never had anything to do with the supernatural.
Yes, you have, Eleanor. Your poltergeist experience.
What's a poltergeist?
A playful ghost, isn't that right, Nell? I wouldn't know.
According to the records of the International Psychic Society, showers of stones fell on your house for 3 days when you were 10 years old.
That's ridiculous.
It was witnessed by your family, the neighbors, sightseers, and the police. In fact, it's the only case ever officially recorded by the police.
It never happened.
Perhaps not, if you say so. I only mentioned it because that's the reason why I wanted you in Hill House.
And it was just kind of a drop-in that you wouldn't think twice, except if we hadn't just seen
The Haunting.
The Haunting.
Right.
And so, yeah, there are a number of those Easter eggs, and, you know, we've only talked about a small handful of them, but I don't know that it's worth sitting through The Haunting to get through it. I think it's probably far more valuable to read the novel.
Right.
But yeah, that was one.
But yeah, there's a lot of things that do tie both of them, The Haunting and Haunting of Hill House, together. And that's rather clever. I just would never, I think, say to anybody,
watch
The Haunting.
So we're not even going to approach spoilers for how things wrap up. I will say I was satisfied. I was satisfied and heartbroken, if that's two things I can be.
It was really touching. Like, I think I mentioned a couple episodes ago how I was watching The Office as well.
Yeah.
But I was in, like, the last, like, couple seasons of The Office where you just cry all the time, especially in the last season. It's just all sad.
Oh, Jim is
and
damn.
So we were, like, watching Hill House and then being like, okay, this is very emotional. Let's watch Little Office. And then we're like, wait, this is now not funny anymore. And all I do is watch TV and cry. And this one, though, I felt like, especially just the way that so much of it goes and so much of it ends, it's like you cry because things are sad and you cry because certain things are traumatic, but you also cry because there's such, like, a joy and love in the family. Like, it's very touching to your heart.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is something, like, as a horror person, we never get that. You know what I'm saying?
Often. Yeah, on our Patreon episode, I talked about how infrequent it is that a horror movie gets, and I cry at everything. Like, I'm a big sap. I'm an empathetic crier.
I didn't used to be. Now I am like, I'll cry at anything.
Good.
Anything.
I'm just like a pregnant woman. but yeah, this had me, you know, both terrified at times, but still getting really emotional at other times. And, like, I think at the time I talked about, the last movie that did this to me was The Orphanage.
Yes.
That was a while ago. I mean, I cry every time. Don't get me wrong. But,
yes.
but
this does kind of have that same feeling of The Orphanage. Of that's more just being sad or whatever. But there, I think the very first time I ever cried because I was happy in a movie was Billy Elliot.
Okay.
It was like the first time when he does Swan Lake. There's something about it to me that I'm like, oh, I'm so happy and in tears. But I had never had that emotion of being like so happy that I cried. And this brought me kind of back to that feeling where it's so bittersweet, but
it
lovely.
Brought you back to that Billy Elliot feeling.
I know. Isn't that funny? In horror, we never get to talk about these things. And this is a show where you can actually There's just so much there.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if things will be written about that component. Just, yeah, the idea that, like, horror, I mean, love it as much as we do, it doesn't typically give you the full spectrum of emotions.
Right.
Like, it'll give you a couple, and a well-rounded movie should, but yeah, they kind of, a little bit stingy on the emotionality oftentimes.
Right, and this, to me, is just everything.
So happy, top to bottom with this show, and I think the cast was perfect. I don't think there's anything I would have changed. I even like little Luke. You weren't as wild.
I didn't love that. I didn't love some of the Poppy Hill stuff.
It's a gamble when you're representing a flapper from the 1920s.
Yeah.
That vocal affectation doesn't know.
Right.
Go
and
over
like
great.
I got it, but I was like, I could take or leave that kind of on the
I
whole
spent the
though.
First couple minutes thinking it was Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yes. I can see that. I can see that. And then you were like, well, no, this is probably a little bit better than that.
So, yeah, I guess we will leave it there. Ladies and gentlemen, happy holidays.
Yes.
And, yeah, join us again. I think we're going to try and give you a Christmas gift of one more episode this month. We're still figuring out what it'll be.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for now, you can find us on social media. We are at Rance Macabre on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We are therancemacabre@gmail.com if you want to email us. We're on all the streaming sites, iTunes, Stitcher, Internet Radio,
and now
Google
Spotify.
Play Music, and Spotify. Very exciting. Spotify doesn't allow just anybody onto its service. That took asking. I think that'll do it for me. You're pretty psyched about the holidays. You Christmas is your big
it's
one.
It's my jam.
Right after Thanksgiving.
On Thanksgiving. I'll do
day.
It on Thanksgiving.
You
yeah.
eat early, set up the tree later.
But I will tell you, New Year's, it all comes down.
Really?
Yeah, I take it down immediately.
Oh, wow. You are, okay.
I'm very regimented because I feel, because I'm a psychopath, because I feel that it shouldn't be any longer than a very certain amount of time. I like to limit myself to that joy.
Oh, it kind of
that time and
makes
no longer.
It more special.
Exactly.
It's like a limited time only.
Exactly. So it doesn't go up before Thanksgiving, even if I want to. And it comes down on New Year's, even if I would want to leave it up. It's just a limited amount of joy. And then I deprive myself of that for the rest of the year. And I look forward to it again next year.
That's funny. Do you listen to Christmas music also only in that short window
yes.
of time? I mean, that makes sense. Other than that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess people... I've heard, yeah, no, I feel like I've heard, like, when pumpkin spice latte started making appearances, like, Christmas music got played in public
at that
point. I mean,
pretty much this year especially, it went from Halloween straight to Christmas this year. No Thanksgiving, it felt. But I won't do that in my own, like, personal, like, headphones. Thanksgiving, I can start the Christmas music. And then I don't really do Christmas music beyond, like, Christmas.
Yeah, I guess
you know,
makes sense.
Because that's kind of weird.
I think people are probably, like, desperate for a little glimmer of joy.
What's your favorite Christmas carol?
I like Little Drummer Boy. I like the more, like, the darker, yeah.
Right.
I mean, I like the
Angela
music.
Angela from The Office.
What's the... I only know the parodies of the Ding Fries Are Done. What?
Oh, the Carol of the Bells.
Carol of the Bells. Yeah, yeah. I like the darker
stuff.
That's
a good one.
Whatever you can turn into like a pretty metal cover.
You're into that.
Those are the ones I like.
Fair enough. My favorite is Band-Aids, Do They Know It's Christmas?
Really? That's your favorite Christmas song?
My most favorite Christmas song. It's not Christmas till I hear it.
Okay.
Not any of the covers either, because then they did like this Band-Aid 2 shenanigans in the 90s.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
I'm not interested in that. I'm talking about the Boy George. Yeah, the people who know this are going, yep, Marilyn, she's in that video. She wasn't supposed to be. Boy George brought her. It's this whole story.
Oh, okay. That's, I don't, I mean, I know some of those people. All right. We will leave it there, ladies and gentlemen. We're done with The Haunting of Hill House for now. I would love to return to this. It sounds like, to hear Mike Flanagan talk about it, it is finished. The Crane family have their end.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be a second season.
No.
And you know what? I appreciate that.
There shouldn't be. It's so complete. The whole thing is so complete. I really, really love the whole arc of the entire thing.
Yeah. I think unless you were to introduce a brand new family, at which point, like, that's a difficult task. Yeah, I don't think it needs any more to be said.
Plus,
think it's
he's
done.
Used all his regulars. He doesn't have anyone else left.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Dr. Sleep.
Me too.
That's going to be exciting. And I think Stephen King even talked about another sequel. Like, well, Stephen King's writing a sequel to The Shining.
That's Dr. Sleep.
But, another extension. I think he tweeted about, I don't know, we'll investigate.
We will investigate. I loved Dr. Sleep, though. I loved that story.
I got to get around to reading it. All right, so I'm going to go do that. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
The Rance Macabre. Cutting.
Cultured.
And curated.
And curated.
And curated. And curated.